Hello, welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author Jesse Klein. Jesse is the head writer and executive producer of the television series Inside Amy Schumer. She's also written for Transparent and Saturday Night Live. Jesse is a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and has done stand-up comedy, including a half-hour special on Comedy Central. Most recently, she is the author of a collection of personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It, released in July 2016. Jesse Klein, welcome to Between the Covers.
I am so excited to be on Between the Covers. Thank you for having me.
Today we're talking about your book, You'll Grow Out of It, that People magazine described as astute, hilarious essays about the perilous path to womanhood that will have you wincing in recognition. Can you give us a summary of the book?
That is like such a nice description of the book. Yeah, it's a collection of essays that... The theme kind of emerged as I was writing it, and it was, I guess I would describe it as just me writing about kind of always feeling like I'm a straight woman trapped in the body of a straight woman, and always feeling my whole life like somehow I'm an outside observer to having to perform femininity, if I can get really vast arcology about it. I did go there, so I'm allowed to do it. Yeah, just kind of always finding all of the like milestones that you pass through as a woman to be more difficult than I think anyone really wants you to talk about.
That's a great description.
Thanks. You wanted it to be 1,000 minutes long, right? Okay, cool.
So after enjoying your book, even to the point of laughing out loud on the train while I'm reading it.
Really? Oh, yeah. Good.
I was hoping you could tell us about the insecurities and embarrassing stories you decided to leave out of the book.
I wish I was prolific enough to have left anything out of the book. But literally, I was just on a schedule where I kind of kept just sending chapters to the editor and desperately waiting for them to tell me when to stop. So the minute they said stop, I stopped writing. Yeah, everything that I wrote is pretty much in there. And insecurity-wise, I think I cover my full gamut of awkward nonsense. Yeah.
How did you decide what to write about from your life?
Again, limited imagination, decisions, very much limited by the only things I could think of. As someone who's done stand-up for a scarily long amount of time now, I kind of train myself. You know, when you're doing stand-up, you're just kind of always thinking, like, well, what am I going to talk about? And you have all these shows lined up, and you're always thinking about material. And I just kind of trained myself to be aware as I move throughout my day of any moments of feeling like this kind of, I guess, like a discomfort, whether it's a really bad discomfort or just kind of a funny discomfort, just to kind of clock those moments and write them down. And then figure out later, like, what was uncomfortable about that. And it can seem like something really small. Like, I have a chapter about the bath, taking mm-hmm. baths, and I've always hated taking baths. I have to take them more now because I'm 1,000 years old and my back is turning into sawdust. So I do occasionally have to medicinally be in one. And like something like that where I'm like, why do I hate this so much? Yeah, I just try to keep track of those little moments and then follow a line of thought about it till I get to some kind of an end where I explain to myself what's bothering me, okay. If that makes sense.
The bath chapter did strike a chord with me because I grew up in a house with 3 sisters, and so there are 6 of us, 5 of us women, and we had no Ooh. Shower, just 1 small bathroom with a bathtub
Ooh.
Only.
so it was an enforced bath.
Right. I share your hatred of baths.
Do you hate it?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, right? Here's the thing. I've gotten more hate mail might be strong. It's sort of cheeky hate mail, but who knew what a divisive issue? I mean, people who love a bath are really PO'd about what I've written. Like, really? Some people are just like, how dare you? Baths are best, but I think it's so gross. So when you moved out, I know you're, like, do you now... Were you just like when you first moved into a place where you had a shower, were you just like, hallelujah?
Yeah, I went to college and it was like, whoa.
Oh, I'm standing up. Yeah. Water's falling on me.
I don't have to use a cup to rinse.
Okay. I'm so happy for you.
So now you know more about me than you ever wanted to.
No, I could talk to you about this for at least 45 more minutes.
So you have a way of describing things that gives the reader a vivid mental image, and suddenly this mundane thing is funny. So for example, you're describing an effortlessly attractive woman on the subway that makes your fancy expensive new dress look like, quote, a Ziploc bag filled with shrimp.
Yes.
And when I read something like that, part of me is hoping that this is how your inner dialogue sounds. Tell me I'm wrong.
I do my best to amuse myself as I go through my day. Yeah, I might have thought, I'm not sure a Ziploc bag filled with old shrimp was exactly what I thought in that exact moment, but yeah, I occasionally tickle myself with some vivid stuff, but then other stuff I kind of have to, you know, have my glass of white wine and sit and write about it. That's like the most white nonsense thing I've ever said in my life. Although sadly it's not. I know I've said more white nonsense than that.
You used footnotes throughout the book, and I found it very effective. It seems like you couldn't help but to add more jokes where it was already funny. Did you plan on footnotes from the beginning, or did you do one or two and kind of think, oh no, this is a thing that I have to continue?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, one of the two people who were at the book agency, I'm so tired. My book agent is a man named David Kuhn, and he works with a woman named Becky Swearin, and Becky had suggested the footnotes thing. Maybe I had written one at one point, and she's like, oh, these are funny, you should do more of them. And yeah, and then as I was writing, I was like, oh, well, this is a nice way to stuff things at the bottom of the page. Yeah, I've always liked books with footnotes. I'd kind of forgotten about them, and I'm so glad Becky reminded me about them. I'm glad you enjoyed them.
I think, you know, I've read other memoirs where they kind of did it, and it's like, it seems like it's hard to do well, so.
Really? Yeah. Oh, okay, good. I'm glad. I'm glad it worked. Because, yeah, it can seem maybe a little twee. Or a little mannered, maybe, mm-hmm. A footnote. Yeah, I tried to earn them. I really tried to see if the thing in the footnote could go anywhere else in the page. And when it didn't, I would just stuff it down like a bad emotion.
Your book talks about how you became a comedian. And I was surprised that you found a job at Comedy Central through a temp agency. So that has to be pretty rare that you actually get a job that you like through a temp agency. Looking back, what do you think about how that all came together?
Okay, so... where was I? Oh, in San Francisco. I was doing a reading, and I was talking about that temp agency. So there's this temp agency in New York called Force One Entertainment, and it's run by a guy named Jeff. And the whole thing about Force One was that all of the other temp agencies that I went to made you take a typing test, and I failed the typing test everywhere. Like, and not by a small margin. I can't type. I literally type with three fingers. Anyone I've ever worked with, when they see me typing, is like, what is that? What are you doing? I hunt and peck to this day. Anyway, and so the thing with Force One is no typing test. You just meet Jeff. And Jeff is, do you guys have the Men's Warehouse commercial here? That guy was like, you're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it. That guy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he looked kind of like that guy. And if Jeff just took a shine to you, he'd like help you place you at an entertainment company. So anyway, I'm doing a reading. I guess I indirectly mentioned this thing, and someone during the Q&A raised her hand and was like, I just want you to know, I also like worked with Jeff at Force One. Like, there were two people in the room who knew about Jeff from Force One, one of whom was someone who I'd worked with at Comedy Central. But yeah, I feel like I should get in touch with Jeff. It was insanely lucky. I can't believe how much airplay Jeff is getting. I said to him, he was like, well, where would you like to, what, he had an in at lots of like little cable companies in New York because MTV Viacom was like based in New York at the time. And I was like, I'm an avid Comedy Central viewer, and I just watched so much Comedy Central, and I loved comedy. And I was like, well, I guess I'd want to work at Comedy Central. And he's like, okay, well, let me see if something comes up. And then they had an opening for a temp. It was very meta because the person I filled in for was the woman who placed temps. So for a few weeks, I was a temp placing temps at that company, which I always describe as being like when you see a dog being walked and it's holding its own leash in its mouth. Do you know what I mean? When you're like, oh, it's so satisfying. It's like, yeah. This time is a flat circle. I don't know. But yeah, it was incredible serendipity to get that job because it kind of opened up a whole world to me that I didn't know existed. I didn't know what TV development was. I'd never even heard of what that was. And then, yeah, one day they called because I was the temp placing temps, and the people in comedy in the development department were like, we just fired our assistant, so we need someone to fill in. And I had that like, I'll pay the rent moment. And I asked the HR people, that was the department I was in, if I could move over. And they were like, sure. And then I became the assistant, and I stayed.
And you...
Was that a long enough answer?
Yeah, that was good. You really worked your way up because you started doing that, and then you became like an executive, right?
Yeah, kind of. I know it's so weird. I'm like, oh, I was an executive. I just got really impressed by myself because it was always, I mean, Comedy Central, I started working there. It was 1998, and it was right when South Park was like exploding. South Park was getting ratings that are not seen on cable. It's kind of boring to get into, but they were having this crazy, like, explosion of money, sort of Clinton era. Like, everything was awash in, like, just so much money. And I was, you know, 22 or 23 years old, and everyone, like, abused their expense account, like, just to the point, it was crazy. Everyone was kind of ripping off this company. But it was so ragtag. And yeah, it was really fun. And it was a small department. And I kind of became friends with everybody. It was kind of like being in college again. And then I just stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed. And yeah, I guess I started as an assistant. And then I went up all those little rungs of like, you're a coordinator, you're a manager, you're a director now. And then I think by the time I became the director, I had started doing stand-up and had this kind of double life where during the day I was like supposed to be scouting comedians and looking at comedians. And then at night I was trying to be a comedian. And by the time I was a director, I kind of knew I no longer wanted my boss's job.
So... body image is a recurring theme in your book, and I liked that you were talking about your feelings about your body without necessarily trying to be inspirational. That said, do you think...
Yeah, I don't know that I can. It was not me holding back from my incredible inspirational speech I have to give. Yeah, go on. It wasn't really a choice. Keep going.
So that said, do you think there's a right or wrong way to talk about body image?
I do not think there's a right or wrong way to talk about body image. I mean, I'm aware of how, yeah, I think all women deal with this, and many men as well. Most people at some point look at their body and are like, maybe not this. And so I want to talk about it and share those insecurities. And then on the other hand, I've always been aware of like when you're at dinner with like your very like your friend who's skinnier than you, like the friend who you're like, well, she's perfect, and then they sit there and are like, I'm so fat, and you're like, oh, do they know, like, are they just ignoring that I outweigh them by like a full ton? And so the only kind of editing I do is just I kind of do try to be aware of like kind of acknowledging like I know I'm not obese. I wouldn't want anyone to like Google me, not that I'm like such a gorgeous unicorn, but yeah, that I'm kind of in that place of like, I think even the most, whatever, models, beautiful, the most quote unquote beautiful women in the world all have moments of looking in the mirror and being not necessarily happy about it. But I try to remember if people are listening that I don't want to be too down on myself, just to remember that everybody's kind of coming from a different place and try not to say anything that would make anybody feel bad, because I don't think anybody should feel bad.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author Jessie Klein about her new book, You'll Grow Out of It. So if you could go back in time and give your high school self one piece of advice, what would it be?
My high school self? I mean, I would have to talk to my high school self for a full year. I was so dumb and didn't know anything and had no hope. I would have to give myself all the advice. I mean, it's such a hard question because, like, the only path you're ever on is the path you're on. I guess my instinct is I would say, like, try to be more confident. But I had to kind of get to where I got to only through the steps that I had, you know? Yeah, be more confident.
Mm-hmm. So what would your high school self think if she saw you now?
She would look at me. Would she know it's me? What are the rules of this time travel movie? Well, you know how in time travel movies, like, there are so many rules they try to establish? I think she would be, if I'm going to be honest, I think she'd be impressed. I think I just had no clue that, like, I could ever get paid to write or be in comedy. That just seemed, I loved comedy so much. And this was, I'm old, so, you know, I'm almost 41. This is pre-internet, like pre-Twitter, YouTube, when, you know, it's so much easier now to kind of make things that just go out there. Mm-hmm. It was, I don't want to say the path is easy now, but I think it just felt further away. So, yeah, I think I would just be in awe that, like, somehow this became my job.
So how do people respond when they find out that you're a comedian? Like, I go to the dentist, and the dentist is trying to make conversation. He's like, so what do you do? And I'm like, I'm a librarian. And he's like, gets this panicked look, like he's trying to calculate how many years it's been since he set foot in a library. So I'm wondering, do you get stuff like that? Do you get, like, annoying responses that are really common? Or
I'm never really annoyed. I mean, I'm really interested in what people do. Like, I didn't know you were a librarian. You're a librarian? That's amazing. It's so fascinating. I actually know a couple of librarians in New York. I went to college with a girl who became a librarian at the New York, like, the cool library with the lions in front. I'm like, I can't believe you get to be in the building with the lions. So I'm fascinated by everyone's job. So if I tell people my job and they're interested, I guess I'm like, yeah, I'm also very interested in, like, a dentist. Seriously, like, what is that like?
That would be an interesting...
Like, you're in everyone's mouth all day. What is that? It's crazy to me. Like, you just, how did you decide? I can barely deal with looking in my own mouth, let alone everybody else's. Yeah, I would happily talk to a dentist for, like, 5 hours about their job.
So you don't get people saying, like, say something funny.
I've gotten say something funny, and I will admit that's a bummer. But I also, you know, I get it. And, yeah, I think curiosity is good.
So I'm curious about your thoughts regarding comedy in general right now. A lot of your material deals specifically with women's issues. And how do you approach a subject like the ridiculous regulations of birth control without being preachy and still ensuring the funny?
Well, I mean, you're referencing, like, you know, a sketch that we did on Inside Amy Schumer. Mm-hmm. On that show, yeah, for sure. Being preachy is a sure way to get people to shut down and turn off. And making people laugh is a really great way to make people pay attention and consider a point of view that maybe they didn't consider before. The hallmark of good comedy also is usually that you're saying something that's true. So on Inside Amy Schumer, we kind of have things that we think are true, such as the politics and regulations of birth control are absurd. And yeah, and then that's, like, something that we want to talk about. And yeah, we try to find the funniest way in to things. And we do have a real radar up for when we write things. We kind of read them out loud at the table. We're always really aware of, like, is this too heavy-handed? Does this feel preachy? We definitely don't want that. And so we try to work around that.
I noticed, looking at the cover page of your book, and since I'm a librarian, I noticed the Library of Congress subject heading that's listed first. Ooh. Is Women Comedians, United States Biography. So that seems trivial and kind of a
throwback. I love that you just told me something about the book. I'm getting the librarian eye view. I literally have not looked at that page. I'm like, wait, what is it under? What is it under? Women comedy?
Women comedians, United States Biography.
Women Comedians, United States Biography. Okay, well, I am a woman. I do comedy. Yes. I live in the United States. Biography. Okay. Checks out.
Yeah, it kind of points to a thing, though, because they don't need a male comedian's subject heading.
Right.
So do you think people are afraid to find women funny?
Are people afraid to find women funny? I... Yeah, maybe it's afraid. I think maybe it is afraid. I was about to say no, but I think yes. I think there are definitely, I mean, Amy, I think, probably gets this one gadillion times a day, and I've got it as a comedian doing stand-up many times where men come up to me after a show and they think they're saying something complimentary, and yet it makes my head burst into flames where they go, "That was really good. I don't think women are funny, but I thought you were funny." And you're just like, I want to wrestle you to the ground and just, I don't want to hurt you, but I want to shake you. I think men, a lot of men, not all men, there's a power in being able to make people laugh. You kind of, yeah, you have a power over someone. You're eliciting, like it's an automatic body response. You're making people laugh at something they can't control. And so you kind of have a little power over them in that moment. And I think it is very threatening for some, not all, men to feel like a woman has power over them.
In the book, you talk about becoming a mother. And yes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What kind of compromises have you found yourself making to your comedy that pre-motherhood version of you would be appalled to hear?
Well, I don't know that I'd be appalled, but I hope pre-motherhood me, I try to be as unjudgy as possible. I think mainly just time. I've been really lucky. We started writing the fourth season of Inside Amy Schumer a few months after my son was born, and because I run the show along with Amy and our other executive producer, Dan Powell, we kind of, it's easier to deal with when you're in charge. But that said, you know, I had a nanny who I had to run home to relieve. I was also at that time breast pumping and had to feed my kid with my own body. And it was, you know, I'd have to leave at an exact time on the dot, and pre-baby me was like, yeah, I'll stay as long as it takes. Like, I'm the person who, like, hangs, and you can't do that anymore. And that sucks. And it's, you know, TV writing, there are so many shows that have really terrible hours. People, like, have to stay till 10, 11 midnight, and I think that's really bad, you know. It feels like more consideration needs to be taken, not just for people with kids, because it sucks to be stuck in an office till 11 or 12 at night, even if you don't have kids. Yeah, my hope as I go forward in my career is to always kind of be on the side of, it's really important for people to have lives, not just for happiness, but for creativity. You have to go do something else. But for sure, parents, it's a real squeeze. I've been really lucky to have, I have a nanny who helps me, but there have been times where I race home to relieve her because I feel guilty if she has to work one extra minute. The racing sucks.
Yeah. Well, I liked your chapter about get the epidural.
That was the one chapter I kind of hoped would have a life outside the book. And I was really thrilled when the New York Times asked if they could excerpt a chapter. And they suggested a different one. And I really wanted it to be the epidural chapter. I think it's really important for women to really feel like they're free to make whatever choice they want to make. And my little experience being pregnant was there was this pressure around the idea of a natural birth, which I think is kind of a false idea. I think the truth of the matter is that there's a natural birth in the state of, like, just being a human giving birth generally meant that many women and babies died. And so there are medical interventions all the time, and there's a lot of myths about epidurals. But I also completely respect people who don't want to have them and want to give birth at home, et cetera, et cetera. But I felt like there was a lot of judgment around women wanting to just, yeah, have, like, something to help because it hurts. I would have an epidural right now if I could, just sitting here. It just, like, feels, it's kind of awesome.
So what's the most interesting thing you've eaten using your Emmy as a fork? I was thinking, you know, you could roast a hot dog or marshmallow, something.
Ooh,
I don't know.
I'm going to tell you something about the Emmy statue. It's heavy. It's not that I would use it as a fork. I would use it against a home intruder. You could absolutely kill somebody with it. It is very heavy, and the little pointy wing is blade sharp. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost, like, not safe to have in your home. Like, I put it in a place where the baby, I mean, I'm gonna have to move it. It's intensely dangerous. Yeah, you can't use it as a fork.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
Yeah, don't try it. Don't try it.
Well, you're no stranger to radio, and I have to ask, what's it like being a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Oh, it's really, I'm totally a stranger to radio. That's the only thing. I mean, oh. I pop in there and do something every few months. It's so fun. Yeah, it's really fun. And, you know, Peter Sagal's amazing and all of the other panelists. I'm always just kind of in awe that I get to be near those other people. I mean, the big moment for me was meeting Paula Poundstone, who was like a huge hero to me when I was a teenager and watching stand-up on Comedy Central. I think she's so, so funny. And I was really grossly starstruck by her the first time I got to be on a panel with her. She's the funniest and so nice.
So is it pretty chill? I mean, you just show up and, or is it more intense?
What do you imagine?
Well, we've gone to it twice.
So then you see what it's like.
I'm just wondering if it's like pressure behind the scenes or something to be funny or.
They've been doing it such a long time. I mean, in terms of the writers and Peter, they've been doing it a really long time. But obviously, they're churning out a really quality show every week. So some pressure is at work. They're maintaining, they're not lazy.
Well, okay. Good. I'm glad to hear Peter Sagal isn't some like evil angry dictator in the back.
Like, I hope, yeah. Maybe I should like lie and then get Peter to like be really mad at me. But no, Peter's really cool.
So you're on Twitter at Jessie R. Klein. Are there other ways readers can find out more about you and your work? Is that a good way?
I mean, other than just the book, yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to keep a small footprint. No, it's really, yeah, I myself am not particularly interesting. But yeah, Twitter, the book, Twitter, the book. Yeah, that.
Sounds good. I saw they renewed Inside Amy Schumer for a fifth season.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
Do you have any other projects coming up? Or?
I worked so hard on the book, and this has been like July has kind of been all about dealing with the book. And I'm doing a voice for an animated show called Big Mouth that's going to be on Netflix, but it doesn't come out till next year. And that's a show that's created by Nick Kroll, who's an old friend of mine. So I'll be a voice on that. Oh, it's the best. Doing acting without having to be skinny is the best. Animation, radio. Anything where I myself can be invisible is perfect. And then I'm going to figure it out. I don't know. I'm going to try and figure it out. August through December is figuring it out time.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your book, You'll Grow Out of It?
I don't want to say anything else about my book, You'll Grow Out of It. I just want to say how much I enjoyed being on the show. You guys are freaking adorable. I'm like very tickled by this experience. Thank you for having me. It's so fun.
Jessie Klein, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Between the Covers is a great title, by the way. Good work. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.